Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Riley, Judge Klopaki, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This calendar of the court today has six cases on its calendar, four of which will be submitted with oral argument, and two of which will be submitted without oral argument, solely on the briefs. The first case is number A18-1011, State versus Alexander. Looks like counsel are ready, and Ms. Mulvihill, you'll be making an argument on behalf of appellant. Okay, very good. You may approach and begin.
May it please the court, my name is Maria Mulvihill, and I'm a certified student attorney representing the appellant Mayo Alexander. The court committed reversible error by failing to ensure the appellant's waiver of counsel was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. Minnesota Rule of Criminal Procedure 5.04, Subdivision 1.4, states that the court must enter on record a voluntary and intelligent written waiver. That is not what happened in this case.
Ms. Mulvihill, are you seeking reversal on a constitutional ground or on the ground of a violation of the rules?
On the constitutional ground. So we would be requesting a de novo review with no deference to the lower court.
And so if there was not perfect compliance with the rules, is that necessarily a constitutional violation?
It is in this case, yes.
In this case, but necessarily in all cases?
Well, if this court feels that a clear error standard would be more appropriate, we also feel that we would succeed under that standard because there is a clear error in this case, having been no waiver.
I guess my question is more to whether we're focusing on whether a violation of the rules is enough, sufficient for reversal, or whether that's merely a factor to determine whether there's been a constitutional violation or a violation of the constitutional right to counsel.
I would say that it's a factor. Looking at all of the facts within this case, you will see that there was a constitutional violation because there wasn't a waiver of counsel here.
Okay. What do we do with the fact that your client fired both his public defender and his private attorney?
So if you review the timeline here, he was represented the majority of the time, which shows that he wanted to be represented by counsel. He never intended to represent himself. Between February and April of 2017, he had a public defender, and then he let the court know he wanted time to gather funds and get a private attorney. So the only time he was unrepresented was between May and August, and at that point he retained an attorney. At trial, he did say that he was having some concerns with his attorney because they had only discussed finances at that point. And instead of the court asking further inquiry into, you know, is there any way to resolve this? Would you like to speak with your attorney? Maybe a continuance would be more appropriate. The court just said, well, you have two choices. You're either going to go forward with this attorney that you don't like, or you're going to represent yourself. And really no waiver was made at that point. It's important to look at the cases here too. Garibaldi and Camacho both say that looking to the facts and having a fact-specific examination and comprehensive examination are important. Looking at the day of trial, there was really no waiver or any discussion.
No, because it went on for such a long time and there were so many continuances, there are multiple discussions throughout the course of the case, it seems to me. And I think it was the pretrial hearing August 10th, when he appeared without an attorney, the district court told your client that if he couldn't find private counsel and he wanted to proceed, he could proceed pro se, and explained what pro se meant to him at that point. Are you saying that we should just look at the last court appearance or the trial?
I think it can all be taken into account. Obviously, the waiver should occur after the defendant decides that they're going to go pro se, because he had never stated prior that he wanted to be. The August 10th hearing, The court did discuss briefly that if you go pro se, you'll be held to the same standards as an attorney. They also brought up, though, that he would receive a packet of information where all of the rules could be found and that he'd be able to look into this further before deciding if he wanted to go pro se. He never received that packet. And then the next time it came up, and at the end of that hearing, he also said that he was in touch with a private attorney and had absolutely no intention of representing himself. So there was really, and the only discussion, the state brings up the April 14th date as well. The only discussion there of going pro se is you're not intending to go forward as a lawyer you're not intending to go forward as your own lawyer pro se. And he says no, and the judge says, good, then you're a smart man. And that's the only discussion that occurs at that hearing. And then it's the August 10th that we just discussed where he should have received a packet, where he'd have more information. And then there's no discussion until the day of trial.
Should we look at the timeline here? I mean, this all started in November of 2016, and it goes to June of 2018. He comes and shows up, fires a lawyer, doesn't have a lawyer. How many different hearings did he have before the court?
He had several, but it's important to note that the public defender is actually the one that requested two different continuances in the beginning, and then his private attorney requested a continuance as well. He only requested two continuances between May and August, which is very reasonable for someone who was qualified for public defender to save up for a private attorney at that point. So although it occurs over a long period of time, it was just due to both the public defender and the private attorney requesting continuances. It wasn't Mr. Alexander requesting those.
And in the February 27 to March 2018, wasn't there an occasion where he advised the court, actually before start of board here, that he would like to represent himself?
I'm sorry, what was...
Didn't he advise the court at some point of time that he wanted to represent himself?
Between what dates?
Between February 27 and March 1,
2018. He fired his public defender at the May 1st.
I'm not looking at a different time frame. I want you to respond to February 27 to March 1. During
sure.
that time, didn't he advise the court, actually, the day of jury trial, and before voir dire, that he wanted to represent himself, and the court appointed a standby counsel who then was dismissed based upon the appellant's request?
That happened August 10th of 2017. Between February and March, no, he did not ever request to go pro se. August 10th, 2017 was the day of trial, and that's when he requested to let go his private attorney.
Was there a jury trial scheduled in 2018?
In 2018? No, the jury trial occurred... I'm sorry. I'm sorry, I have the dates wrong here. Yes, the jury trial occurred February 27th to March 1st. So yes, that was the time that he requested. He stated that he was having some difficulties with his private attorney because they'd only discussed finances at that point.
But so did he also then say he wanted to represent himself?
At the point that the court said you're either going forward with this attorney or you're going to represent yourself, he said, I guess I will represent myself.
And that's when the court appointed standby counsel?
They attempted to appoint his private attorney.
I don't
attorney.
Understand what you mean by attempted to appoint. Did the court appoint a standby counsel?
There was a discussion about appointing him standby counsel, but he never had, his private attorney did not stay to be standby counsel.
Didn't your client indicate he didn't want mass standby counsel?
That is correct, yes. And I think it's also important to point out that there wasn't much discussion as to what standby counsel was. So it's unclear that the appellant even understood that there was a difference between the private attorney representing him and being standby counsel. And that would be on the judge to explain. And looking to the record here, there was very little discussion about it. And that also goes into the waiver, too. There was really nothing discussed. And the judge at that point even says, there's two different times where they say, I'm concerned about whether or not you know what you're doing here. And still doesn't explain the waiver conditions and goes forward with trial.
In Garibaldi, one of the reasons why we reversed in that case was because he did not, I'm paraphrasing or reading now, did not unequivocally fire his attorney. Rather, he merely indicated that he couldn't afford his attorney, but that the attorney was supposed to show up at the hearing. How does that compare to this case?
Well, his attorney obviously was at the hearing. And some of his concern, I think, with keeping him standby counsel may have been about finances, but that's not on the record, so that would just be speculation. But also, Garibaldi, so they looked at whether he had a chance to consult with previous counsel, whether he had standby counsel, and then conducting the waiver, and none of that happened here.
But it seems like, whereas Garibaldi was not unequivocal, he seemed to equivocate, it seemed like Mr. Alexander was pretty firm in his decision.
When it came down to it's either this or this, he did say that he would like to represent himself at that point because he wasn't given any other options, and the judge really did not explain that to him. But this case is very similar to Garibaldi, where the case ended up being reversed because he did not ever have a chance to consult with counsel prior to the waiver, so we can't look back to say, oh, he knew of his waiver rights because he did not. There's nothing on the record to indicate that
the original public defender appointment occurred in November of 2016. Is that right?
Correct, yes.
And then in April of 2017, he discharges that lawyer.
His public defender, yes.
Yeah. Right, that was the first reason in the Garibaldi. The third reason was that Garibaldi was not offered the benefit of standby counsel to assist him. And again, how does that factor in Garibaldi compare to this case?
Well, Mr. Alexander did not have standby counsel.
He was offered, right? He had an opportunity.
He was offered, yes, but he was not. The record isn't clear that he understood what standby counsel was. So I think it's important to go back and read through the transcript because it really just. See if I can find the quotes here.
I thought there was a point in time between February 27 and March 1 where the trial court appointed Plesha as standby counsel, but he was dismissed by your client.
Correct, and that all occurred over the course of a few sentences. So the judge appointed him, and then let me find the exact quotes here so I'm not paraphrasing.
My reading of the time frame and the record, it looks like to me like your client was more interested in continuances that one after another for various reasons. I don't want the public defender. Oh, I'm dismissed. I'm going to get my private attorney. Then he shows up. Well, I can't afford the private attorney. Want another continuance. The court grants multiple continuances. And so that becomes a pattern of this case. Make some objection and you get a continuance.
I'm sorry.
Tell me why I'm wrong in that sense, that impression that I made.
Yes, because looking at it, it did occur over a long period of time, but Mr. Alexander only asked for two continuances between May and August so that he could save up money for a private attorney. It was never him requesting the continuances prior to that. It was the public defender because the first date, first they asked for a continuance, it was conflicts with their schedule is really what it came down to. So Mr. Alexander had nothing to do with those continuances, and then there was just the two between May and August. But after that, the continuances were due to his retained private attorney asking for continuances, which he had no control over, and I believe it was also because of scheduling conflicts. And I believe you're kind of touching on that he was delaying on purpose here, looking to the cases where delaying tactics come forward on the record. There was nothing on the record here to suggest that him delaying his trial would benefit him in any way, and he was respectful throughout the process. He never made any claim otherwise. But in state sites, Worthy, Finn, Benter, and Brody, all those cases, as far as delay tactics, there was a very clear reason why they were delaying. In Worthy, he didn't want to... he wanted to be the last of the defendants to go to trial. In Finn, the defendant didn't want to testify against the co-conspirator. We don't have anything like that here. And then the other two are also very similar. Brody, actually, he had standby counsel, and the public defender was active throughout that trial. So I don't think a delay tactic is anything that is came up in this case.
That our Supreme Court I think it's Worthy noted the impact of the then defendant, the impact of his prior experience. He knew how the system worked. What's the situation here?
I see my time is up. Is it okay if I answer?
Yeah, please go ahead.
Is this your client's first appearance in district court on a criminal matter?
I don't believe he had a trial before. No, this would have been his first. So he had no prior experience with this.
Thank you. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Ms. Jenny, on behalf of the state.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Linda Jenny. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota. First, I'd just like to clear up a couple things that appellant's counsel mentioned at oral argument. First of all, appellant did have two prior felonies in Minnesota, so he is familiar with the criminal justice system. And also, the claim that appellant only talked to Mr. Plesha, his privately retained attorney, about money is belied by Mr. Plesha's statements at the hearing on February 27th, when he said that he had answered all of defendant's questions in the interim since November, the past November. That was when trial had originally been scheduled, and that he had been in contact with him since then, and that Mr. Plesha was prepared for trial that day. In fact, that day, that morning, he had talked to the prosecutor about pretrial issues and other things. They were prepared to go.
Did he say that he answered questions about a particular topic? Which topic? I mean, did he specify?
No, he did not.
So it doesn't necessarily contradict Mr. Alexander's statement that they talked only about money?
Well, it suggests that there were other topics discussed besides money in the interim and the fact that he was ready to go to trial at that point. And as this court knows, it's a fact-specific determination. And we've all reviewed all the cases, I'm sure, and there are no specific fact patterns that are identical. But this court should look at the background experience and conduct of this appellant to determine whether the waiver is valid. And a defendant's waiver, this is in Worthy and many of the other cases, without good cause to allow appointed counsel to continue representation may by itself be sufficient to constitute a valid waiver. Here we have a defendant who fires his public defender and then delays things for a long period of time. There were 12 hearings, which I discuss in my brief. I won't belabor what happened there unless this court has questions. And then he dismissed his privately retained counsel on the day of trial after his privately retained counsel said he was ready to go and had already discussed issues with the prosecutor. And then he dismissed that same attorney as standby counsel. So it's clear that...
But at the time he dismissed his attorney, Plesha, the district court initially appointed Plesha to standby, but Alexander appeared confused about what standby was. He said, he's not adequate counsel for me, and the judge said, well, that's who you have. It's either him or nobody. But because of the fact that I'm concerned about whether or not you know what you're doing here, I'm going to have an attorney who's experienced in these matters sit by your side. I can dismiss him if you like, and then you're on your own. How would you like to proceed? How you would like to proceed is totally up to you. It's not my choice. So do you think that's an adequate explanation of what standby counsel does?
I think there was also a place, Your Honor, where the court told appellant that standby counsel would help him with jury selection and cross-examination of the witnesses. I believe that's in my brief. And yes, I think that the record, reasonable inferences from what you just read to me and the record as a whole during that hearing shows that this appellant knew what standby counsel was going to be, at least in part, and decided he just didn't want that standby counsel. And then that same afternoon, or February 28th, he comes back and says he wants a continuance. I think it was all part of a delay tactic, and that is why he dismissed his standby counsel. And I think that is what the prosecutor was saying through some of these hearings, where the state kept saying, well, this case is getting stale, we need to do something. But the court was somewhat kinder and did not say these kinds of things until the end, when it said to this defendant, she said to the defendant, we need to do something now. We need to go ahead.
But yes, he wanted continuances, which could be seen as delay, but what was his purpose? Does there need to be an ulterior motive? In some of these cases, like Worthy, for example, the defendant had sort of a strategic reason for seeking a further delay, but is that present here? Does it need to be?
Your Honor, I don't know that it needs to be, but it is present here. This defendant was out of custody early on. I point out in my brief, I think it was perhaps a year before, and that was his motive, to stay out of custody and to not go to trial. He was fine. He had no reason to go to trial. Only bad things could happen to him if he went to trial. So that was his motive. And as this court pointed out, the concept of proceeding pro se was discussed with this appellant at various points. I go through that in my chronology. And he never gave a really good reason either, I should point out, for why he wanted to get rid of either of his attorneys. And that is a factor that this court should consider as well. So, in conclusion, I'll be glad to discuss any of the cases, but what I'd like to point out, too, is just in summary, given the multiple inquiries and hearings here, given appellant's behavior and conduct vis-a-vis his two attorneys and his lack of a reason for discharging either one of them, and the whole context of the case, he clearly waived his right to counsel. I'd like to point out the Jones case, too, which I discuss in a footnote in my brief, which talks about the three ways a person can waive counsel. Waiver by conduct. It's the state's position that he waived. It doesn't seem that waiver by conduct would apply, because waiver by conduct is a situation where the defendant has to say, I don't want to proceed pro se, or he hasn't said, I will proceed pro se, which this client did say, I will proceed pro se. So it would seem that wouldn't apply. But the third way, forfeiture, does apply, and the facts in Jones are remarkably similar to this case, where the defendant continued to ask for continuances over and over and over and over, and finally was required to go to trial without an attorney, and the Minnesota Supreme Court said that was forfeiture of the right to an attorney under those circumstances.
I get the sense from the manner in which you briefed that, that that's an alternative argument for you?
Yes, it is an alternative argument because it's our position that he did waive his conduct, the conversations that he had with his various judges. There were different judges at different hearings. And also, as some of the case law points out, it can be presumed that the whole concept of proceeding pro se is discussed at some point when a person has an attorney for the length of time that this defendant had an attorney. There were 12 hearings, and I think at 7 of them, he was represented by counsel.
Appellant relies heavily on the Garibaldi case in which we reversed. Could you please summarize your response to that argument?
Sure, I will take a look at that. That, oddly enough, that was my case in 2007. Yes. The differences between this case and Garibaldi are that Garibaldi, the whole point with Garibaldi was he wasn't eligible for a PD. He wanted one, but he couldn't get one. He never unequivocally fired his attorney, as this defendant did twice, and he was not offered standby counsel, as this defendant was. In fact, not only was he offered it, Mr. Plesha was appointed standby counsel, but then appellant wanted him discharged. And it looks like Mr. Garibaldi had actually very little contact with an attorney of any sort ever, whereas this defendant had, as I said, an attorney representing him at many of these 12 hearings where continuances were requested by appellant or by appellant's attorney. If this court has no more questions, we would ask that appellant's conviction be affirmed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Jenny. Ms. Mulvihill, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Maria Mulvihill, certified student attorney here on behalf of the appellant. Just a few additional notes as to the delay and having a motive. Mr. Alexander was offered a stayed sentence of 18 months, so he wasn't facing going back to jail as far as he knew, so that would not be a motive for him to delay in this case. As far as his attorney...
Well, what reason did he give for firing the last lawyer?
Mr. Plesha, at the private attorney, he said he'd only discussed finances, so he was concerned about that. And he said, actually, on the transcript, the page 8 there, he says, we've not discussed anything in regards of the case or anything. Only thing we have discussed was about finances. And Mr. Plesha responds to that, communication is a two-way street. So he doesn't say that's not what happened.
Except that Mr. Plesha also informed the trial court that he'd been in communication with your client since November, and this is at the transcript, page 7, and that he had always been able to respond and address any questions or concerns appellant had.
So we just don't know what they discussed.
And the lawyer suggested he's ready to go to trial that day. I mean, to believe your client, we'd have to conclude that the lawyer said he's ready to go to trial when he knows nothing about the case.
So at this point, the court should have asked a few more questions to inquire as to why he didn't feel comfortable going forward with his attorney, but that's not what happened here. And also just going back to the rule here, none of this happened.
Well, if we're talking about the constitutional approach as opposed to the rule approach, mm-hmm. we don't have to spend a lot of time talking about the rule, do we?
I think it's still important to look at the rule, though, because that's the basis of our constitutional argument. He did not knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waive his right to counsel here. He was never given. There's many questions on Form 11 that he should have been read and asked, and then he should have been told about, you know, possible defenses, circumstances, mitigating circumstances, that sort of thing. The court never questioned him about any of these things or informed him about that.
Well, given the facts outlined in the complaint, what would the mitigating circumstances have been? He beat his wife with her mother in the house, and the police came right away. So there were witnesses. And so what would the mitigating circumstances have been that the judge should have explained?
As far as we know, there could have been a self-defense claim. I don't know as far as what the details
are. She's lying on the ground, and he's beating her face to a pulp. So I just...
It's an argument that could be made, though, and it's something that he should have been informed of.
Do we look at reasonableness? Is that a reasonable thing for the judge to be required to say or inform him?
It falls under the rule, and it's outlined that that is what it's supposed to be brought up, to have a knowing and voluntary waiver. So even though there may not have been mitigating circumstances that would have helped him in the case, it's still nice to tell him that, you know, there could have been.
Well, it might be nice. But does it reach a constitutional violation not to?
It does, because under the rule here, and not particularly because of that reason, but if you look at the totality here, he just was never advised of all of his rights. He never gave a proper waiver of counsel.
Certainly was advised of the fact that the state was going to seek an upward departure and that there was going to be a Blakely trial for aggravating circumstances.
At the day of trial, he was informed of that. And it's on the record, too, that he says that had never been brought up to him. So it's also unclear if his private attorney already knew about that and never brought it up to him as well, which would have been something he should have known about.
But he then knew it that day, and how did he respond? He responded by saying, I don't want standby counsel, that I want a continuance.
I'm not sure that that's the order it happened in. I think that may have been after. But either way, it should have been. I mean, at that point, he had been thinking he was looking at 18 months of a state sentence at that point, and then now he's looking at 36. At that point, it would have been important for him to speak with his attorney further. They possibly could have worked out their differences or his concerns about the finances and them not having discussion further. And the court did not see that appropriate to do. They just said, you're going forward by yourself or you can have him. So, but there was really no discussion of a waiver at all at that point.
You sent us a letter with supplemental authority, the Rhodes case. What would you like us to take away from that case?
Just the de novo standard of review at that point, okay. The constitutional issue. And just in conclusion, the appellant, Maya Alexander, was denied his fundamental right to counsel as a result of his invalid waiver and therefore must have his conviction reversed. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is deemed submitted and the court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days. You did well, Ms. Mulvihill. Good luck to you. Counsel for the second case may come forward and get ready.